So hello, Professor Dasgupta. Thank you very much for joining us. As we've discussed ahead of time, the goal of this discussion is to go over the genesis of the ideas surrounding spin glasses and replica symmetry breaking, which we bound roughly from 1975 to 1995. But before we get to this material, I'd like to ask you a few background questions, if you don't mind. First, can you tell us a bit about your family and your studies before reaching university, right? The context in which this took place.
Yeah, so I studied in India till master's. And then in 1973, I got admission at the University of Pennsylvania for doing PhD.
But before we get to that, can you first tell us what got you interested in physics, for instance?
Oh, okay. Oh, well, I have been interested in science throughout, even when I was in high school. And that was actually in Calcutta, this is the eastern part of India. And there is a college there, which has a very, very good tradition, and you know, it's quite famous. It's called Presidency College. And people who wanted to do science typically went to that college for their undergrad training. And I was not interested in these professional courses, medicine or engineering or something like that. So I knew that I was going to do science. Specifically, physics is something that actually was decided more or less when I found out that, you know, many of the people who did very well in our school leaving exam, they were joining that college and they were taking physics. So that was some inducement, although I liked physics from the beginning. Physics, whatever we learned at school was, I found that very interesting, but then there was this further inducement saying that that the people that did very well in the school leaving exam, many of them actually are joining Presidency College and they plan to do physics. So I thought I'll have a good bunch of people to have as classmates.
So what then drew you to pursue graduate studies in theoretical physics in particular?
That was sort of, in some sense, dictated by, first of all, I liked theoretical physics. I enjoyed understanding the different, undergraduate, I didn't learn a very much advanced physics, but whatever we learned, the theoretical part I liked. And experimental research in India is very difficult because for various reasons, the labs are not so well equipped and so on and so forth. So even the experimental part that we did as a part of our curriculum, some experiments we had to do as well as the theory part. There, the labs, again, were not very very well equipped, and sometimes things didn't work and all that. So I mean, we are not very impressed with the experimental aspect. All the theoretical part we could read from books and we could hear from lectures, and that was, in some sense, more interesting. So after 3 years in this college, I went to Delhi University for doing a two-year master's. That was the standard thing to do in India at that point. I mean, 3 year bachelor's and then 2 years master's. And after that, if one wanted to do PhD, then one would go on to do that. And there again, a lot of people in our class were thinking of going abroad to do PhD. And that was another reason why I also sort of decided to do that. But I knew at that point that I'd do PhD, but where that I'd do that was not clear. But since many of my friends were going abroad, many of them to the US, so I also decided to do that.
So what drew you to work with Brooks Aris at UPenn in particular and going abroad?
So I was at Pennsylvania in 1973. First year, as you know, in the US system, typically one takes courses. So I did that too. Then a qualifying exam I cleared in the summer in 1974. And then I started discussing with various faculty members as to, you know, what they're doing, what would be the possibility of me joining them as a student. So in statistical physics, quantum matter. So first of all, I should say that, you know, in India, when I did master's, then my training was in high energy physics. Condensed matter, solid state physics was not, at least in Delhi University where I studied, it was not very popular in the sense that there are not many people who were working in this area. But there were quite a few people who were working in high energy physics. So after going to Pennsylvania, I talked to some of the professors there who were doing high energy physics. But they sort of discouraged me because high energy physics was not in a very good shape at that point. I mean, there are not very many interesting things going on in that field. So then, of course, I started talking to other people who are in other areas of physics. And Schiffer was there. Bob Schiffer was there at the time. And Brooks Harris was there and a few other people. So I talked to them and eventually found out that, you know, the kind of things that these guys were doing. Brooks Harris was there for a while, and then Tom Lubinsky also was there. He joined as a young assistant professor just a couple of years before I went there. And they are working together, and we took a course on statistical physics from Tom Lubinsky, which I liked. So then, I mean, when they said that, yes, there is a possibility of working with them, then I decided to do that.
So just to understand, so why did you choose UPenn to begin with? Did you have the choice, or was it difficult to find a graduate position at that time?
It was not very easy. One had to apply to, like, 10, 15 different places and then choose among those who are willing to take you. So I had two, three offers maybe. And among them, I knew about UPenn because some other people that I knew, they were actually studying there at that point. And they gave a good report on graduate study there. So that was the main reason.
So can you tell us a bit how, because you said you joined Brooks Harris, but also you were closely in close proximity, I guess, with Lubinsky. Can you tell us a bit how the group was functioning at that point with students and PIs?
It was a small group in the sense that number of students, postdocs in the group was not very large. But Brooks and Tom, they were actually working together at that point. I mean, many of the papers that either of them wrote were actually joint papers. And I think there were maybe one, two, three, four or five graduate students and one postdoc. So it was like 7-8 people in the group, not a very large group.
And you would meet as a group, or you were individually working with, would the students working with each other? Just a feel for the interactions.
A lot of interactions. I don't think we had formal group meetings, but there were informal meetings in which people were talking about what they are doing and various discussions could take place. So it was a good atmosphere. People were very helpful and a lot of communication among the students in particular.
So you didn't work on spin glasses at that point, but did you hear about them? Were you aware of the topic?
Yeah, sure. So
how?
I'll just give you a little background in the sense of what this group was working on at that point. So there are a couple of sort of exciting things going on, and which in some sense also made me interested in this, to do a PhD in this field. One was, of course, this idea of scaling the normalization group and things like that. That was about 10 years in the making, but a lot of people were still working on critical phenomena and application of the normalization group to various problems and things like that. That was one interesting thing. The other was the study of disordered systems in general. Started with disordered magnetic systems, quark correlation, and things like that. That was also becoming popular in the sense that a lot of new problems were coming up, both experimentally and also theoretical developments. And this group, Brooks Harris in particular, just had done this Harris criterion for deciding whether a disordered system will have a sharp phase transition or not. This Harris criterion was done maybe 2-3 years before I joined, something like that. So in general, they were interested in looking at systems with quenched disorder. And the main interest when I joined was basically dilute magnets. So if you have a magnetic system and then some sites or some bonds are missing with some probability, then what kind of transition one expects, what kind of phase diagram, whether the transition is the same in universality class as that for the pure system. All these things were being discussed. I think 75, 76, all these spin glass papers started coming out. The Edwards Anderson paper and then the Shrington Kirkpatrick paper. And there were discussion about that in the group in general. And Brooks and Tom, they started working on spin glasses while I was there. In a sense, there was another student, a Chinese student, who was put on that problem. And they wrote some paper on doing this epsilon expansion for spin glasses while I was there. So there were, I was aware of spin glasses, although at that point I didn't do any research on spin glasses. And it was recognized as a very important problem and how to deal with it. And so there were lots of discussions about that.
So after graduating, you decided to move to a postdoc with Changkeng Ma at UCSD, where you actually did then work on spin glasses. So can you tell us a bit how you got to choose or to go work for that postdoc and that collaboration come about on spin glasses?
Yeah. So maybe, so why I went there is, again, in some sense, we apply to various places and then we choose the one that we think is the best for you. So that was the reason. And why spin glasses? I should tell you a little bit about that summer of 1978. I graduated in 1978. Mm-hmm. And before going to La Jolla for the postdoc, I actually spent a fairly long time in Europe. And that was, large part of that was this little school, the condensement.
Yes.
So since I was, I had done, for the PhD, I had done some work on population and random resistor networks and things like that. So I was interested in disordered systems and this school was specifically on that topic. So I attended that school. And that was a great experience in the sense that, very many of the sort of leaders in the field were there. They gave lectures, as you know, lectures. I mean, there are extended lectures and things like that. So Phil Anderson was there, Scott Kirkpatrick, Tom Lubinsky, a few others who were actually basically doing the work in this field, in this fairly new field at that point, were there. And there were, of course, a lot of discussions about spin glasses in the school. Actually, I first heard about replica symmetry breaking at the school.
Okay.
In the sense that this Almeida Thouless paper had come out, and so people knew that the replica symmetric solution is not the correct solution in the ordered state. And then what to do with it is was not clear. So people were looking at various possibilities and so on and so forth. So, I heard about the possibility of replica symmetry breaking. And people were looking at it and trying to find what is the right way of doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So spin glasses, P.W. Anderson gave many lectures on that, of spin glasses and also glasses and sort of possible connection between these two were in some sense discussed. Scott Kirkpatrick was there, so the Shrington Kirkpatrick model, all those things, numerical work was discussed. Tom Lubinsky was there talking about normalizing group and things like that. So this, of course, told me that, this is a very important field. And when I went to work with Changkeng Ma, he was also interested in disordered systems. So he had done this work, Simri Ma argument and things like that, to find out in the random field systems whether they will have the ordered phase and things like that. So he was interested, and so we started discussing about spin glasses, and eventually ended up doing some work. At that point, this replica method was somehow people were skeptical about it, in the sense that, you know, all this business of n going to zero and so on, how to take that limit. Because I mean, you know, many people have used it at that point, but there were also questions about whether this is the right way of doing things or not. So we spent some time trying to find some alternative to using replicas to get this coin star average. Because I mean, we didn't succeed. So I mean, but then, you know, in general, we got interested in spin glasses, and what they did there actually didn't have much to do with this infinite range model. It was basically short range, you know, sort of Edwards Anderson kind of model. Mm-hmm. And also the work was not really asking very deep questions about what is the nature of the phase transition, if there is a phase transition, and so on and so forth. But there are also lots of simulation work that was coming up at that time, particularly Kurt Binder, and they did a lot of simulations on short-range model glass. And we're trying to understand some of those results.
So do you know where Shankeng Ma's interest in spinning glasses had come? I mean, did it start with you, or was he interested in them before as well?
I don't think he did any work on spin glasses before I joined.
Okay.
But I mean, this being a very important problem in the area of disordered systems, I'm sure he had thought about it or discussed with other people about it.
So I guess you were at La Jolla when the Parisi solution came out. How yes. did you react to it, you and Shankeng? What was the original impression?
Actually, I would say that at that point, it was sort of looked upon as a sort of very ingenious way of making replica symmetry. But what it means, it was not clear to anybody at that point, I think. So I actually, if I remember correctly, didn't spend a lot of time on trying to sort of figure out what it is all about, and trying to understand what this proto parameter function actually means. I didn't spend a lot of time thinking about that.
But was it clear that it was a solution, or was it not clear? Did it look like a trick, or that it actually might actually be the...
Well, to begin with, the replica method was considered to be a trick. I mean, for many, many years, people used to call it a replica trick. So there were all this, in some sense, skepticism, so to speak, about using replicas and taking the n going to zero limit and so on. Then on top of that, breaking replica symmetry, and then on top of that, instead of having a simple order parameter, having something which is actually a function. All these things were very new, and people thought that it's a very interesting way of looking at things, but the actual meaning of that was not clear. And at that point, at least, you know, I don't remember spending a lot of time on it.
So from La Jolla, you moved to Harvard to work with in Halperin's group. So how did that happen to begin with?
So I spent 2 years in La Jolla, and at the end of 2 years, actually, I got a job offer. I got a faculty position at the University of Minnesota.
Okay.
But before I got the offer, I also had written to just a few places to do a second postdoc. So, and then I got an offer from Harvard, and then I decided that I'd postpone joining at Minnesota, and then spend 1 year at Harvard. So that was, that's how it worked out. Wasn't clear exactly what I'm going to work on at Harvard. And this was sort of a free postdoc, in the sense that, although it was in some sense Bart Halperin's group, but there were lots of other people. So I'll talk a little bit more about this 1 year I spent there. A lot of other people, mostly postdocs, young people who were around, and Bart told me that, you know, you should interact with these people, and if there are interesting things that you think you can work on, then you're free to do that.
So one of the people who was around at the same time as you, I think arrived about the same time as you, was Chaim Sempelinski. This is a time where he started working on spin glasses as well, by himself and with Anita Zipelius. Can you tell us a bit how, I guess you were in the same offices or in the same suite. Can you tell us a bit how this happened, or do you have any insight?
Not the same office, but we're in the same building. And actually, when I joined, both Anita and Chaim were there already for maybe 1 year, a little more than 1 year, something like that.
Okay.
And they were working on this dynamical theory of spin glasses. And by the time I got there, this work was more or less done. Mm-hmm. Since I had done some work on spin glasses earlier, it was natural for me to actually talk to these people. And we had a lot of discussions. So, you'll see that in their papers, at least, my name is mentioned as one of the people who had discussions and so on and so forth. So, Anita, I didn't have so much discussion because she left maybe a few months after I joined. But Chaim was there throughout, so and I had a lot of discussion with him, and also ended up doing some work with him also.
Yeah, exactly. You wrote a paper with him on spin glasses. Can you tell us a bit how that came about? I guess out of these conversations, but more specifically.
Yeah. Right. So this now has a lot of overlap with replicas and replica symmetry breaking. Because when I got there, Parisi's paper was out, and as I said, there was a lot of discussion about what this means, this way of breaking replica symmetry, what it means. And of course, Chaim and Anita, they had done this dynamic. So one obvious question was whether it was possible to have some kind of a interpretation of this outer parameter function in terms of dynamics. So that was one thing that we had some discussion about. And actually, Chaim wrote a paper, single author paper, which I'm sure you are also familiar with, where he gave a dynamical interpretation of this Q of X. He assumed that in the earlier work, they had formulated dynamics in terms of this MSR formalism and things like that, which didn't require replicas. So that was one of the, in some sense, attractive points about this way of looking at things. So then the next issue was whether from the dynamics it is possible to have some interpretation on this order parameter. So one thing that the time assumed was that there is this hierarchy of timescales. That since it's a complex system and very long timescales, of course, long timescales are well known for spin glasses to begin with. There are a hierarchy of timescales, all of which will go to infinity in the thermodynamic limit. But there is order. In the sense of a finite system, there will be these timescales. If you order them, then you will have the shortest timescale. Shortest meaning it's still going to infinity as in the thermodynamic limit, but among those infinite timescales, the shortest one. And that would correspond to averaging over that timescale. That would give you this Q of 1. When it's the Q of x going from 0 to 1, the Q of 1 end, that was assumed to be what you would get if you calculate the order parameter by averaging over times, which are this shortest among this hierarchy. And the other assumption was that the other end is Q equals x equals 0, Q 0. And here, the Chaim's assumption was that if you now average over the longest of this in the many timescales, then what you would get is this Q of 0. So then using this dynamical formalism, he was able to then work out the dynamics and get results which look very similar to this Parisi's result with this new order parameter. So that was done by himself, of course. I mean, there were lots of discussions about that, about that. But the problem that I worked on was trying to sort of connect that dynamical description to some kind of a static description. And the starting point was this TAP equations, Thouless-Anderson-Pommard equations. At that point, one knew that there are many solutions, locally stable solutions of this TAP equations. So there the idea was then this origin of this whole spectrum of timescales, we tried to relate that to averaging over these TAP solutions over longer and longer sort of distances in phase space. So again, Q1 was just looking at one TAP solution, and then Qx equals zero is what you would get for this water parameter when one did an average over all the TAP solutions. Of course, I mean, at this point, we didn't know very much about, you know, how the overlap between two TAP solutions look like, what is the distribution of these overlaps and things like that. So we had to make some assumptions. And under those assumptions, we got essentially the same thing as what Heim got in his dynamical description. And again, you know, this was very similar to the Parisi picture. So the whole thing was basically an attempt to try to understand what this Q of X function means, which was not clear at the time. And eventually, I mean, I think 82, 83, around that point, people were able to basically figure out what this is. And the eventual understanding was actually not quite the same as what we had proposed, in the sense that the thermodynamic average, statistical mechanical average that you get when you average over all the solutions, it turns out that it's not Q of zero, but the integral of Q of X between zero and one. So there was some differences in the interpretation. That's how things worked out.
So I mean, as you said, you went to Les Ursches and you spent the summer of 78 in Europe. So throughout those years, were you keeping in touch with your peers you met at the school, or back in Paris, where there were some other, you know, parallel efforts? Mm-hmm. So were you in regular contact, or just preprints, or what?
Not regular contact. I mean, I have kept in touch with some of the people that I met at that school, but not many of them actually are working on spin glasses. I remember there was this Garel, Thomas Garel, who was he was actually my roommate in Les Ursches.
Okay.
And he did some work with De Dominicis and others on spin glasses. Who else was there? Bob Pelkovitz was there, but he didn't do much work on spin glasses. Many other people were there, but who later became, you know, very, very famous. But I have kept up touch with some of them, like, you know, Giovanni. Jean-François Giovanni is now
okay.
Paris. I have kept touch with, and we are doing similar work these days.
So after a year at Harvard, you did take the position in Minnesota, and you moved there. And I think your first PhD student there, Amitabha Chakrabarty, worked with you on spin glass problems, especially on the RKKY spin glass model. What were you then pursuing? Can you walk us through what you were trying to achieve?
Yes. So actually, I mean, you know, I was at Harvard for just 1 year, and we started with Heim. We had done this work. And there's another interesting thing about that work was I haven't seen much work on that later on. Was we are looking at this staggered magnetizations. So basically, there is this JIJ matrix in the Sherrington cryptographic model. And you know, you can look at it as a random matrix and look at its eigenvalues and eigenfunctions. It's a semicircular law for the distribution of the eigenvalues. And we were looking at the projection of this on-site magnetizations onto the eigenvectors of this random matrix, the IG matrix. And when the system orders, this staggered magnetizations also will have non-zero balance. So we are looking at basically the distribution. And whether, if you look at the edge of the spectrum, the largest eigenvalue, whether the staggered magnetization for that eigenvalue or that eigenfunction, whether that's extensive or not, and things like that. So there again, there were some did some numerical work on that, the simulation of the SK model, and then calculating these projections of the on-site magnetizations onto the eigenvectors of the GIG matrix and so on. So I got involved in some numerical work on spin classes. Mm-hmm. Monte Carlo simulations I did for the first time there.
Okay.
And actually, the didn't have a lot of computing facilities these days. So I remember I actually went to the IBM Research Center, Yorktown Heights, where I knew Scott Patrick from the summer school. So I actually spent some time there to do the Monte Carlo there. So I mean, I got involved in some Monte Carlo work dealing with spin class models.
Okay.
You see, the other thing that you may find interesting was that Peter Young also, when I went to IBM to do this, Peter Young also was visiting. So we ended up having a lot of discussions about timescales, in the sense that, you know, if you look at now the SK model below the transition or dead state, then if you want to, for small systems, finite systems, if you want to now equilibrate it, how does that time scale depend on the size of the system? Because one of the things that goes into this sort of Parisi-Kendall description, number of pure states, is that there will be time scales which will diverge as the system size goes to infinity. Mm-hmm. And started some work, which afterwards I didn't follow up, but Peter did. And there was a paper by McKenzie and Young where they showed that it goes exponentially as some power of n. And so on and so forth. So I got involved in doing numerical work on spin class models. So when I went back, when I took up the job at Minnesota, first year I didn't do any research because, you know, I was teaching for the first time, so that took up all my time. So that's one of the reasons why I didn't follow up with the work that I started with Himes and Polinsky. Mm-hmm. But then second year, at the end of the second year, I think the student joined me. And then, you know, since I've been doing numerical work on spin classes, I thought it might be useful to actually look at realistic spin classes and try to understand whether they exhibit phase transitions or not.
I see. And you had better computational facilities at Minnesota. Yes. Then at that point?
Minnesota, we were lucky because Cray was based in Minnesota. The Cray, the company, computer company who made this computers, they were based in Minnesota. So University of Minnesota actually had a Cray. Computing was much easier there. But still, you know, it's still not anywhere near what people can do now. But we did what we could at that point.
Francesco?
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, so this was more or less the time when there was a kind of an intense debate on the nature of the spin glass phase, so between the droplet picture, the RSB picture. So were you involved in these discussions, and what's your impression about these discussions at the time?
I was not directly involved in this discussion. Although, I mean, the models that we looked at are sort of short range or RKQI kind of models. So certainly whether the infinite range model, mean field picture applies to these systems was a relevant question. So I did read these papers, Fisher and Hughes, and droplet picture. Droplet picture was in some sense more familiar to me because I had earlier done with Shankingma some work where you have these clusters which looked at as two-level systems and so on and so forth. So I was aware of this controversy at that point, but didn't do anything to try to resolve that controversy by looking at the order state in more detail to see what kind of signatures of this way or that way one could get. And I don't know. I mean, you know, it seems to me that the controversy is not completely resolved, right? So I mean, you know, there are evidences on in favor of both the pictures, but.
And what was your impression about the community at the time? How it was organized? I mean, the spin. I mean, people working in spin glasses. What was the
in like the US in particular? Yeah.
Yes.
US seemed to me that apart from this, you know, of course, this Fisher and Hughes, what was done in the US, but others, at least the ones that I talked to at that point, were more interested in. In some sense, realistic models. I mean, there was this builders. There was this special purpose machine that was built. I think there's Ugielski is the person who was involved, and Robin Watt was involved. Peter Young was involved. These people I know very well. So I have had many interactions with them. So I mean, that was not the main question. That I mean, it was of course the, one of the fundamental questions about the nature of the ordered state, but more realistic models, it is people who are doing numerical work, they were concerned with trying to understand their behavior. Whereas in Europe, I think because of Parisi, many much more work was being done on these midfield pictures and trying to check whether that works for short range models.
Maybe a different way to ask the question. So you were in Minnesota. How connected were the different groups in the U.S. working on spin glasses? Would there be, you know, regular seminars, or would you invite each other? Would you travel, or would you exchange students or postdocs? Just a feel for, or how, or in other ways, how isolated were you in Minnesota, or how connected were you in Minnesota?
See, those days there were no, even internet was not there. So having connections was not so easy. You had to make phone calls or you had to send letters. We used to send, we used to discuss. I mean, Peter Young I have known from, you know, my PhD days. And as I said, you know, there are other occasions where I did interact with him. And so that's one person I talked to, maybe on the phone sometimes, correspondence by mail. And David Hughes and this guy, Robin Butt, they were at that point at Bell Labs. And I had connections with them. And, but you know, the community was not very large. Because of all this, in some sense, difficulties in communicating on a daily basis, it was not, it's not a very, very tightly knit group of people who are working on similar problems or anything like that. We met occasionally. I mean, I visited some of these places and those people came. So,
did someone ever try to set up a network of people working in the US, like, I don't know, obtain some funding or something, like to work as a community? And exchange
In this this area, you mean, say, in, on spin glasses at
these systems?
Not that I know of.
Okay. So no one ever.
I'm not interested in other disordered systems, like, you know, superconducting systems. I mean, Josephson junction arrays and things like that. There was also someone I knew at Ohio State University who was working on that. So we did some work. And there's an experimentalist in Minnesota who was working on that. So. Yes, disordered systems was still quite popular, and one was trying to understand many properties of those. But it was more or less individual groups, as far as I remember.
So in 1987, you moved to India, to the IISc in Bangalore. What drove you to join the IISc at that point?
So my... it was never my intention to sort of stay permanently in the US. So after 2 years in Minnesota, in 83, 84, actually I took leave from there and came to IISc to spend one year as a visitor. And at that point, I liked IISc very much. So later on, at that point, there was no possibility of getting a permanent position there, because for various reasons, I mean, it depends on who's the director and whether he wants to have more positions in physics and things like that. So I went back, but then 86, 87, a position was offered, so I came back.
Okay. So, and shortly after joining the IISC, you started working you left the field of spin glasses and started working on structural glasses in particular. How did that intellectual transition come about?
Well, first of all, the similarity of spin glasses and structural glasses people have commented on earlier also. Even in this 78 school, Phil Anderson gave talks on both spin glasses and structural glasses. And he said that the spin glass was a simpler problem because there you have disorder which is imposed on the system, whereas structural glasses disorder has been generated by the system, things like that. So, I was interested, but then when I came to IISC, again, you know, the people that were here, in particular, the person who was sort of instrumental in, you know, asking me to come and join IISC and so on, this is Professor Ramakrishnan, T.V. Ramakrishnan, who is actually very well known, a physicist who worked on localization and things like that. He also had worked on freezing of solids. There's a theory called Ramakrishnan Yusuf theory, which sort of a Minfield theory of freezing of a liquid into a crystalline solid. So he was here and I was interested in disordered systems. So one of the things that we were discussing at that point was to see whether similar things can be done. The Ramakrishnan Yusuf theory can be used to study glasses. It's coming from that direction, or this TAP kind of description, whether that can be also extended to glasses, where you look at a local minima of the free energy functional and see whether there are many minima and stuff like that. So yeah, that way. After that, I think after coming back to IISC, I have not worked on spin glasses.
So another group that sort of suggested this pivot, right, was Kirkpatrick, Thermalai, and Wolness, who made a direct analogy between spin glass and structural glasses. Were you following that work? What was your reaction to these ideas at the time?
Mm-hmm. I was following, I actually thought that was very, very nice in the sense that, you know, the way that they connected this spin glasses or quartz glasses to structural glasses, very interesting. And by that time, the replica symmetry breaking, its physical implications or interpretation was more well established. So it didn't have some of the concerns that people used to express earlier, when the concerns about the replica method, and in particular about replica symmetry breaking, because now it was more or less established as a good technique, and also what one means by replica symmetry breaking, that also was somewhat clear at that point. So this made more sense. And what we did was the first thing that I did on glasses was trying to find this multiplicity of minima. That was, in some sense, a TAP picture for glasses.
I see. Can you help us understand what was the structural glass community at that time? How was it structured, or the different points of views that were present? I mean, it was the late 80s, early 90s.
Again, you know, I am not aware of any sort of, apart from there were groups in Paris and Rome and so on, who were sort of close-knit groups where several people were working on these things together. But other than that, I am not aware of much of a structure in the community. Since the US, as far as I know, there was no such large group. I mean, there were people like Peter Wallinus who were doing this kind of work. But again, you know, he was more or less doing things by himself. And there were people who are doing simulations on glasses, some of them in chemistry departments in various US universities. But no big group as far as I know. Neither in India. I did collaborate with many, many people in India, but that was sort of more on personal one-on-one basis.
So one of your first paper on structural glasses adamantly concludes that there's no growing static lens scale in glasses.
Yes.
What was your vision of the structural glass problem at that point?
Our vision at that point was that there is no static transition. What we said at that point was actually, whatever length scale that one is talking about now, I worked on that later subsequently. In the paper itself, there are one or two lines which says that on very long time scales, you don't, or in a really purely static sense, it is difficult to get any length that is growing. But we missed looking at intermediate times. That certainly is there. If we had looked at intermediate times, then we'd have seen that there is a growth. And the other thing that sort of goes convinced us that there is no length scale was this finite size scaling, the elasticity time with system size. And there we saw behavior which is quite opposite to what one finds in spin glasses. Time scale actually, instead of increasing a function of system size, we found that it decreases, which still stands. But the title of that paper is of course misleading at this point.
So at Minnesota, at IASC or elsewhere.
There also, I think there's one thing that, I mean, if you're looking at historical perspective, one thing that I should mention is that when I came back to the Institute, 87, around that time, or early 90s even then, computation was almost impossible. So the computers that we had, first of all, I mean, given the number of people who wanted to do computation, was very inadequate. Wanted to make reservations in some sense to use the computer for a certain period of time. So this work was actually done in collaboration with a friend of mine who used to work in a aerospace company located in Bangalore.
Okay.
And they had fast computers. So whatever little computation we could do at that point was done over there. And you can see from the paper that, you know, it's the computer part, simulation part is not really all that great, in the sense that short time scales, small system sizes, and things like that.
Simulations have come a long way, for sure.
Yes.
At Minnesota, at IASC or elsewhere, did you ever get to teach about spin glasses and replica symmetry breaking? And if yes, can you detail the context and the content?
Mm-hmm. I have taught a course on disordered systems as a special topic course in our statistical mechanics quantum matter group.
At IASC?
At IASC, yes.
Okay.
And I've taught it a couple of times. The second time I taught Shrikant Shastri, whom you know probably, who is also in Bangalore. Mm-hmm. So we taught this course together. So he did half of it and I did half of it, but we have taught it maybe three times.
So this would have been the first time in the mid 90s, or just an idea of when that would have been?
No, much later.
Okay.
So the last one was maybe 2-3-4 years ago. Then the previous one was 5 years before that. Then again, okay. 5 years before that. So started after in the 20s. And there, I mean, we just don't talk about only spin glasses, but disordered magnets, percolation, but spin glass occupies a substantial part of that course. And we do talk about replica symmetry breaking there.
I see.
And there are sometimes other places where I have taught about this is, there are these summer schools which are organized once in a while, and there I have talked about replica symmetry breaking.
Okay. Is there anything else that you'd like to share with us about this era that we may have missed or skipped over inadvertently?
Not really. I mean, just want to mention that I came back to replica symmetry breaking in the context of glasses many years after thinking about that for spin glasses. And that was done, I mean, when we're looking at a basically a liquid in the presence of disorder, spinning disorder. And I got interested in that because some work on superconductors, static superconductors, where you have a vortex lattice, and then pinning centers are very common there. One wants to understand what effect this disorder has on the vortex lattice and the transition to the vortex lattice. And there, this one-step replica symmetry breaking, I looked at. Again, in collaboration with some people in France, actually, is a student, Fabrice Thalmann. I don't know, maybe Francesco knows him. But we had some joint program with people in Grenoble to look at superconductivity, in particular, this flux lattice and things like that. So this question came up in that context.
I see. So that's what, okay, so that's what re-interested you in ideas of replica symmetry breaking, where ideas of land scales came back in a more convincing way in your mind.
Right, and this is somewhat different in the sense that, you know, there this replica symmetry breaking we talk about is in liquid state theory. So I mean, one has this HNC or some Parker-Cievic and this kind of liquid state equations that tells you about the structure of the liquid and stuff like that. So there again, you know, Mézard, Parisi, they introduced this notion of replica symmetry breaking in that context. And we use that to study pinning disorder in the vortex liquid.
And I think from that point on to today, you've remained interested in structural glasses and invested in that.
To a large extent, yes. Yes. Yeah.
Do you still have notes, papers, or correspondence from that epoch? And if yes, do you have a plan to deposit them in an academic archive at some point?
It will be very difficult. Even if you have, it will be very difficult to find because this would go back, like, you know, what, 40 years. And as I said, you know, when we were working on these things, then there were letters exchanged because email was not available at that time. So those letters were there. I mean, I would be very surprised if I can find those letters. Letters with Haim, for example, or with Peter Young, or Robin Bart, these people. I mean, I was in the US, I was working on spin glasses. There were correspondence.
So you brought them back with you to Bangalore, but you're not sure where they are. Is that?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I mean, you know, those days one is to have this filing cabinets and then one would put all papers, at least I used to do, I mean, all papers relevant to a particular publication in one file and keep it there for posterity. But not anymore.
Well, thank you very much for this conversation. It's been a real pleasure.
Okay, thank you. I mean, I enjoyed sort of reminiscing about those days, whatever I remember. And thanks for asking me to talk about this.